And here he is, direct from 710 ESPN Seattle. Former football standout and national ESPN celebrity, Rock Heward. And this is it. This is vanquish or perish. This is win or go home. And all I'm hearing about is Zeke Elliott. Somebody's got to stop Elliott at the Dallas Cowboys.
And Dak Prescott. And how about them Cowboys, Dave? How about them?
Well, how about they're America's team? So
Oh, yeah. Hey, by the way, great to be back with you.
Same here.
You know, we used to do this somewhat regularly.
We did.
This is awesome.
And then I got vanquished for on Danny O'Neill. And then we had a morning show that started as well.
That's because they started wanting to hear you more on ESPN.
I guess so. Hey, I'm curious. Let me turn it around real quick to you, though, Dave. And I love your feel of some of these things at times. When the Seahawks were really rolling, right? 12, 13 Super Bowls, the buzz was palpable, right?
Yes, right.
I think even a non-football fan walked around and said,
absolutely.
Geez, what in the heck is going on?
Like the 95 Mariners.
Are you feeling any of that right now for this team
season? I feel concern. I feel there seems to be a level of concern just below the surface that, you know, this is not guaranteed. And that ebullient optimism that I used to feel doesn't seem to be there.
Yes, I think that's well said. And Salk and I are trying to figure that out this week a little bit, because this season we have felt some of this mojo, the numbers and the listening, and just things have gone back to some of those early marks. And, you know, I said this week, it's almost like Christmas this year, where you wake up and each Sunday, like, okay, who's going to show up today? Like, who's this new star?
Right,
who's
right.
this new
That's
face?
Right.
Who's this Jaron Reed? Who's this Jack Griffin? Who are some of these new stars? And yet now, here we go. As you just said earlier, the biggest stage, the playoffs, win or go home. And like, where is everybody? Like, where's all of this emotion? And the only thing I can think of a little bit, Dave, is that the fan base right now is somewhat in a parallel path with this team, that this is not a noisy team. That in those years, there was Richard at the front making noise, making national headlines, just loving it, just loving the attention, loving the limelight, loving everything, and wanted it, like coveted it, like bring it on, like yelling at Aaron Andrews, obviously, at that huge moment in 2013. But, you know, that team was brash. That team kind of forced us passive-aggressive Northwesterners to be like, you know what? You're right, Richard. I am aggressive. I'm no longer passive-aggressive. But yet, I think the fans following this team's lead, which is not nearly as noisy, led by Bobby and Russell probably at the front of the line, your two captains, your two Pro Bowlers that just aren't necessarily that personality.
I think maybe we're still feeling the trauma from the blown second Super Bowl. That you get so invested in the team, and yet it can be just one interception away from tragedy.
Well, if that's it, then I'm retiring. Like, if you can't get over that, like 5 years ago, then I am done. I really hope it's not that, for crying out loud, especially with all these guys, a bunch of them who were in high school when that went down.
Yeah.
Like, the starting corner, Trey Flowers, was not even in college when that happened.
So tell me what the flow is like. As somebody who has, you know, been in the game, what is it like when you come to a game like this where it is all on the line? And I know that I keep hearing, it's just another day, right? It's just
it's all faster. Yeah. I mean, you feel it. You as a competitor, you knew it from your earliest days. You know, it's fun, a little league. And then when you get to the tournament, like, oh, we got to win or we go home. Oh, yeah, it's fun in the basketball game, but we get to the state tournament, like, you got to win and you go home. So you've had that built in you, so that doesn't disappear. You're not some robot when you get to this level, so you know it. Like, the magnitude and the stakes are higher. It is a tick faster. Every moment is a bit brighter, and, you know, you're on national TV Saturday night. Man, there's only four games going on this weekend, and you happen to be one of them.
Something else, too, I think, that's serving them from the first Super Bowl is that the rules have changed. Right? The refs are getting pretty picky about, you know, turning you, running you down for swerving out of your lane.
Yes. I hope some of that dissipates in the playoffs. Usually it does. Usually that's the message from on top. Like, all right, let the boys play. Like, we can have our agenda. We can try to do this. We can try to institute this way. But you know what? Once we get to this time, let's make sure that we let these competitors, these guys who are laying it on the line, and for some of them, be the last time they ever play a football game.
So the good news is that the injury report is great.
It's a little lighter.
Like 51 people.
Yeah, it's a little lighter. You know, I'd be curious, Dave, if you had J.R. Sweezy's foot, if you'd be working today. Tegney wouldn't. Tegney would take like a month off if he had J.R. Sweezy's sprained foot.
I'm sorry, I don't know the details.
Yeah,
of
he's got
foot.
A sprained foot. These guys right now, man, you're right. The injury report is better.
Are we talking about like a turned ankle?
No, we're talking about like a seriously sprained. Like, there's some serious stuff going on. But for these guys, it is suck it up time. So you're right. The injury report is a little better than than it's been, but I guarantee you that DJ Fluker's hamstring, the J.R. Sweezy's foot, that the bunch, Shaquille Griffin's ankle, if it was us in the normal working world now, may not be able to suck it up and go to
that?
Work.
Do they wear like little dosimeters that show how many plays they're good for? Or?
No, those guys charted. If you look at the sideline, you'll see a and there's a large cast of not only players, of staff, of trainers, of assistant coaches, of assistants to the assistant coaches, of analysts. There's a lot of eyes on that. But, you know, as we talked about earlier, kind of with those refs, let these guys play. These are also guys that now are in the final stretch, and they want to go. You know, you're three wins away from a Super Bowl.
But is their attitude really, okay, this may end my career if I go in for this next play, but by golly, I got to get that board, I got to get that ball across
career threatening, that may bring a little different dialogue. We're not talking about that, thankfully, with any of those guys on that injury report you look like. Yeah. There's a lot of bumps, there's a lot of sprains, and there are on the other side, too. Like, you go through the course of this season, you get to this point, and you are so juiced for the playoffs, for this win or go home. And that adrenaline at about 5 o'clock tomorrow does wonders to many of those sprains and owies.
Tell me about the about Cowboy Stadium and Jerry World. I've never been there.
Yeah.
I hear it's something spectacular.
It is a spectacle, man. I've done a couple bowl games there, a couple of these Texas A&M and Arkansas plays.
They got the world's biggest Diamond Vision screen.
It is enormous. Every little detail down to, like, you hit the elevator button and all of them have that Cowboy star on it. I had a friend of mine that played for the Cowboys, and while that was being built, Jerry Jones brought the team over, brought them over on buses to let them see what was coming. This was in the off season, and he said to them, hey, listen, any of you want to gripe about your contracts and you want to come to the owner and talk about what you want, realize what you don't have, and that's a $29 million a month mortgage payment on this baby. So that kind of started to quiet some of the, what? Yeah, $29 million a month. Wow. As that thing was being built. And they do things a little bigger down there in Texas.
Plus, that's a write-off.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. I don't want to get into that, Dave, but yeah. I will say this, though, as far as where they could have gone, whether it was Soldier Field in Chicago or to Arlington to play these Cowboys, give me this one. Give me this matchup. They know each other. The weather will be perfect. It is a spectacle. It's a party in that place. It's 95,000 people.
So is that,
that
a distraction? Having that huge screen that, I mean, all the players can see that, can't they?
Yeah, you can kind of look above. You know, in fact, this also cool little tidbit. We had that college game, and there was a coach, an offensive line coach for Texas A&M, who stood back, not on the sideline. He stood back in the tunnel where the team ran out, and he could watch the play from back there. So as a player, you're kind of underneath it a little bit. But this coach was like, no. I'm seeing this much better if I step back away from the bench. So, yeah, it is, man,
it's massive.
Have
those screens become a factor in the way you play? Because you can look up sometimes and see who's chasing you, can't you?
Yes.
Rather than having to look back?
Yeah, you got to be able to multitask. I couldn't even task. So I don't know how some of those guys multitask.
Don't sell yourself short. No, you are a star, man. You still are a star.
Dude, this felt kind of good. Feel good to get back into rhythm.
I like the fist bump. You're the only guy who comes in here and fist bumps me. I had to remember what you were doing. But once I caught on, I felt like just part of the club.
Well, let's hope right there. Let's hope, you know, this fan base that caught on to the previous version, right? The previous version of the Seahawks finds way. They did it this year, man. They packed that stadium out. They had the time of their lives. But I think you're spot on. There's a little bit of nervousness. Let's hope that dissipates with a huge win. And when I come talking to you next Friday about a playoff game, either New Orleans or L.A., this city is lit once again.
Yes, sir. Brock Huard, 710 ESPN. Thank you, Brock.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Hannah Scott joins us now. She will be keeping tabs on the legislature for us this session. And one of the biggest issues to come up is what you do about dangerous dogs and whether certain breeds are inherently dangerous. So tell me what they're doing to deal with that.
So there's a proposed bill in the legislature that is going to be has been pre-filed. And basically what this means, right now we have cities across the state who have been allowed to enact their own bans or further restrictions on certain dogs because of the breed that they are, and that they dub that breed as dangerous. This would bar cities from doing that because the state, this proposal would want to see it based on behavior of the dog rather than just the breed of the dog. So this would ban cities from enacting bans or other restrictions on certain breeds of dogs unless several conditions are met, basically behavioral tests of dogs. So it really encourages the cities to look at the behavior of a dog.
Now, behavioral tests basically mean going dog by dog?
So they would have to meet an American Kennel Club canine good citizen test.
Okay, so how would a law like this be used? if I'm a landlord, could I say you may have a Chihuahua, but not a pit bull?
This does not have to do with, for instance, your scenario, a landlord's ability to say anything like this. It has to do with the city's ability to ban a certain breed based
on a city.
Yeah. From so several cities across the state have already done so on their own. Everett has dubbed pit bulls dangerous dogs, so they have certain restrictions that are allowed in that city for that. Enumclaw all-out bans certain pit bulls, as do several other cities and other parts of the state. This would ban those cities from doing that. They would not be allowed to ban those dogs based on breed or even have other further restrictions on those dogs based on
breed. So could they ban, so does that apply to every animal then? If I want to now decide I want to own a giraffe or, you know, some exotic animal?
No, because this is, again, very specific to these dogs being dubbed dangerous because of their breed only. It wants you to look at the behavior of the dog as opposed to just the breed of the dog.
Hmm. What else?
Vaccines are up, so this is kind of interesting. It basically allows us for something called a titer test, which can show, so you get your MMRs, right, your measles, mumps, rubella, as a kid, and kids have to prove that they, when they go to school, that they have all of those immunizations, but it's a series. So there's something called a titer test that can show that even after you've had your first dose, or sometimes just naturally, kids can develop antibodies to these certain illnesses. So this would allow you to have that test done and have a doctor sign off on it, and that could be your immunization record for the school. So in other words, you wouldn't have to get that second dose of vaccine that maybe you don't need.
Now, there's a lot of concern when we start talking about vaccine rules because of people who think that they could cause autism or things like that based on studies that have been refuted. But this seems to be saying that if your child already has sufficient immunity, they may not need an additional vaccine. Is that the idea?
Yeah, absolutely the idea, that you don't need to give that second dose, let's say, because they already developed that immunity. So what this does is allows the doctor, your healthcare professional, to say when you bring your kid in for that vaccination, they would be required to say, you don't necessarily have to get this vaccination. Another option would be we can run this test, see if they already have the antibodies built up either naturally.
And this immunity test you're talking about, this is a recognized thing.
It is
thing.
a very recognized thing. Yeah, it is recognized.
How come we haven't done
this
before then? Because it would save a lot of unnecessary vaccinations, it sounds like.
They do it in some places. I think New Jersey has a similar law. We don't have one. They want to put one here. There's been some different proposals on vaccines in past legislative sessions here. This is the first I've seen this one. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that goes.
There's been some progress on going through all those unopened rape kits.
So we're hoping for a lot of progress on that in the legislature this session. So we talk a lot about the untested rape kits, the backlog at the State Patrol Crime Lab. This is a little different. Another major issue here in our state and actually across the country is that there are simply not enough forensic nurses, the ones who administer the rape kit if you're raped and you go to the hospital. I've talked to a local woman who was told they couldn't do it at the hospital she went to and to take a cab to another hospital. She instead went home and showered, and it destroyed all of that evidence. So at any rate, this would require hospitals. They would have to notify you if you went to the hospital as a rape victim within 2 hours that they didn't have anybody available to do that kind of a kit on you, or they would face a $2,000 fine, the hospital.
And they're going to take up opioids this session?
This is also interesting. High schools and colleges would have to have naloxone on hand.
To handle overdoses.
And
are overdoses happening in schools now?
I don't know that it makes headlines every time it does, and that's unfortunate. But I know that opioids are definitely an issue in schools. I think this is a good idea, life-saving on school. I don't think it's something necessarily that's going to encourage any use that isn't already happening, and I just think it's a step in the right direction. I do believe this came up once before and got sent back to the Rules Committee last session, so there's a little more time that they could possibly deal with this session.
So I imagine the most controversial is going to be the dog bill and banning pit bulls or not banning pit bulls. Yeah. Does it have any support?
It does. Right now, it's early in the stages, and what I've seen is just Representative Sherry Appleton is the one who's introduced this. I haven't seen yet whether there's any other support, and I don't know that this has come up before, so it remains to be seen. I'll keep an eye on it. Again, kind of early, no hearings or anything yet just on this, but interesting things to watch.
Kyria's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Shutdown day 14, divided Congress day 2. The new Speaker of the House is telling the president he should take yes for an answer on reopening the government without money for a border wall. We called up Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation, to see if anybody's going to budge here.
Well, yesterday, after newly minted Speaker Pelosi was sworn in and assumed that mantle once again, made clear that for her and for her constituents, that there is no deal that could be on the table that that they will sign off on if it includes border wall funding in the form of a wall, as the president describes it. But what Democrats did sign off on and pass yesterday was funding for the agencies, including Homeland Security, an extension of funding. Remember, that is what the shutdown is about, is being able to continue to fund that quarter of the U.S. government, and a disagreement over what the size of that funding package could look like, because the president has asked for $5 billion in border wall funding, and what had been offered had been $1.3 billion. So it was a difference between those two numbers that sort of led us to the standoff. And with Democrats newly sworn in the majority in the House, you had Speaker Pelosi say, we will fund the government and open it up, but no way will we sign off on a border wall. So we are right back at this impasse. You have congressional leaders going to the White House today, but the president is making clear from his position, wall funding or no deal, Democrats saying no deal if there is wall funding.
So the idea of these shutdowns is to put pressure on somebody, but besides people who want to visit national parks and can't, and people who, you know, might be audited by the IRS but won't because they're not reporting for work either, where's the pressure coming from? What's the pressure to reopen the government?
With that lack of pressure, so to speak, that you're talking about, is something that has added into the political calculus that maybe people here have a little bit more time to continue staying in their corners and not negotiating. The counter to that is we're getting closer to a lapse in paychecks, right? Because paychecks are often delayed a week or more in terms of how people are paid and how often. And so that pinch directly in the pocketbook may be right around the corner for some federal workers. There's also the question about some of these emergency funding packages that were put together to sort of tide people over, particularly within the Coast Guard, since their paychecks come through essentially the Department of Homeland Security rather than the military. How long does that funding hold out for? So we are about to see some of these more immediate deadlines impact people potentially. And so this is a question here of how long can people hold out before there is a political cost to both sides that forces Democrats and Republicans to start talking. I know for a large part of America, this just looks like a political food fight all right. over again. But for federal workers, you know, some of them may start feeling this in their pocketbook.
Right. But again, if federal workers feel this, does that mean that they suddenly march on Washington and demand a wall? There are some people who think we have too many federal workers as it is. And if the Coast Guard paychecks stop and people decide, okay, it's against the law, but I'm going to go on strike. I'm not going to show up, and I'm not going to, you know, show up for my Coast Guard patrol. That makes us even less secure. So I don't get the logic of this, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with you to just say, as a senator, or Shelby, a Republican senator from Alabama, who was on my program last Sunday and is head of appropriations, he said, frankly, we both look silly. All of us just look silly. So there are lawmakers, particularly in the Senate, who want to get some deal put together. And Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, is one of those lawmakers who's been pushing for some kind of big package, some kind of immigration deal that could maybe make all of this political fighting add up to a win in some way for both sides. He's arguing that something needs to be put on the table for Democrats, like protections for so-called dreamers, those who came here illegally as children. Does that entice Democrats in the Senate to get on board with any kind of bill that would include funding for the border wall? Is there a trade to be made? That's the hope, that maybe all of this comes at, you know, a political win rather than political cost. But right now, we're not in a negotiation.
Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation, her guests on Sunday, two of the key senators in any potential immigration deal, Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham. And now, striding confidently to the microphone, all smiles, trying not to trip, trying to remember the names of all the people he has to thank, digging in his pocket for that note he wrote. Here's Cairo's film critic Tom Tangney with the top 10 of 2018.
That's right. It's finally here. And since I have so many films to get through, 10, we're going to start right in.
Number 10.
Why did that happen?
Because I pressed it too.
Oh, you pressed it too. Oh,
well, that made it sound even better.
Wow, right? Oh, even nice. Bigger. Okay.
You're going to play your own stuff today. Okay,
yeah,
good. That's fine.
I can play it.
Yeah, his
good.
Leg's not pressing the button.
So number 10, I already kind of cheat by giving you three films, so I'll cram into number 10. Number 10, Black Panther, The Avengers Infinity Wars, and Deadpool 2. The superhero genre doesn't get much critical respect, Dave, but if the powers that be could ever figure out how to combine the sociological grounding of Black Panther, the existential ruminations at the end of Infinity Wars, and the genre-subverting wit and sarcasm of Deadpool 2 into the same movie, they'd have a film that might top this list instead of coming in at number 10. But yes, I did like them. Okay, I'm going to play this, number 9, okay?
Number 9.
Well done.
The Greenaway Alphabet. One of the delights about putting together one's own top 10 list is that you can include a personally idiosyncratic fare like this documentary about a favorite, albeit obscure, filmmaker. Quite possibly the most cerebral director alive, Peter Greenaway allows his teenage daughter to quiz him about the singularities of his own films using a favorite technique of his, the alphabet, as an organizing principle. A playful and insightful doc about an aesthetic genius, at least in my opinion. Okay, now, back to some movies that people might have heard of.
Number 8.
First Reform. This is a big hit at the film festival. Ethan Hawke plays a minister suffering a crisis of conscience about his role in this fallen world, both on a personal and philosophical level. Written and directed by Paul Schrader, this challenging and rather jarring film seems a perfect counterpoint to Schrader's screenplay for his 40-year-old masterpiece, Taxi Driver.
Number 7.
A Quiet Place. I love how actor-director John Krasinski can have fun with a clever premise. Making a sound could cost you your life without sacrificing all the delights a genre picture can deliver. A very successful commercial film with an art film idea. See avant-garde director Guy Maddin's 1992, Careful. That takes place up in the Swiss Alps, and there's an avalanche. Everyone's afraid of making much sound because if they make a sound, an avalanche will come and destroy you. I think, Quiet Place is going to be a classic horror film down the ages. I really think it's going to survive the onslaught.
Number 6.
Number 6 is another double bill, Blindspotting and Black Klansman. Two films that deal with a tricky state of race relations in this country. The first by a first-time director, the latter by longtime veteran Spike Lee. Hamilton's David Diggs and his lifelong friend Rafael Casal both wrote and star in this semi-autobiographical film about the tensions in their own interracial friendship with an ever-gentrifying Oakland as the backdrop. And Black Klansman is based on an actual decades-old infiltration of the KKK by a black Colorado police officer. Lee's footage of Charlottesville and Trump at the end is as incendiary as it's meant to be.
Number 5.
I could pick up faster on those cues.
Okay. Do you want to do the next four?
Yeah, I'll do the next.
Okay. Eighth Grade, what Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird did for high school, Bo Burnham's first film does for middle school, recreating the personal humiliations that helped define adolescence. Actress Elsie Fisher could not be better as 13-year-old Kayla, who must endure an excruciating eighth grade in order to come out the other side. Social media makes her journey all the more perilous and heartbreakingly funny.
Number 4.
Much better, Dave. Isle of Dogs. I should have relented at the beginning.
Go ahead.
Isle of Dogs, my number 4 film. Quite likely my favorite dog movie ever, seeing in how it eschews sentimentality. This Wes Anderson film is just what you'd expect from Wes Anderson. A defiantly quirky, charming, and wholly original story done with stop-motion animation just to amp up the degree of difficulty and tweeness. It may trod well-worn ground, man's relationship with dogs, but it does so with so much offbeat flair that you may find yourself grinning throughout the entire movie. A voice cast that includes the likes of Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, and Scarlett Johansson serves the clever script very well.
Finally, a movie I actually saw.
Number 3.
You didn't see all those superhero movies at the beginning?
I saw Quiet Place.
Give me. I'm a man of the people. Quiet. Oh, you didn't? Okay. So anyway, number 3. I'm stepping on my own.
Number 3.
Is The Favorite. The ingeniously perverse Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos turns his sights to 18th century British royalty with a scathing account of a vicious rivalry for the affections of a sad sack Queen Anne. That these suitors are both women only provides added dimensions to the nastiness of the milieu. The anachronistic vulgarities and the occasional distorted lens work also slyly undercut the supposed propriety of the upper crust. The sharp-tongued script is well-served by Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone, all Oscar-worthy.
Number two.
Number two, Roma. A stunningly gorgeous black and white reminiscence of Oscar-winning director Alfonso Cuarón's childhood in Mexico City in the 1960s. Focusing on his family's nanny, but encompassing all the members of the relatively well-to-do family, Roma reveals the profundity of the mundane and revels in the richness of life, whether bitter or sweet. A classic that will never show its age.
Number one.
Perfect, Dave. Number one film of the year, The Death of Stalin. Scottish writer-director Armando Iannucci has crafted another brilliant, biting satire, this time about the power struggles in the Soviet Union following Stalin's death. We may never have to live through another Stalinist regime, but the ridiculous jockeying for power is ever relevant. And despite the onslaught of hilarious one-liners in the midst of the most farcical of scenarios, the film never loses sight of the tragedies just outside the camera's frame. Black humor at its best. There you go, Dave.
Can I just, go ahead, as a man of the people, I've got a 90% on this list. What? That I have not heard of nine of ten of these. Are you kidding? I've never even heard of nine of ten of these.
But that's my job, is to bring you those nine of ten that you've never heard of. I thought I was being a man of the people by mentioning A Quiet Place, a huge horror hit. Black Panther.
Black Panther, I saw.
Didn't see any of that.
Infinity Wars?
No, I've never watched those.
Oh, and Deadpool,
I might watch Deadpool,
you
too.
You love Deadpool, too,
I love Deadpool.
Chris.
Yeah, but let me, come on, seriously. What happened to the Viggo Mortensen movie that I want to see? Or, you know,
that's
Vice?
That's the worst.
Or, I mean, I don't know.
Green Book is the worst.
Really?
Really?
Yeah, G. Scott and I, last night, had one of the best discussions. That's his favorite film of the year, hands down. To me, it's the worst film.
All right, then I won't see it either.
No.
At least I heard
that's,
of it.
That's a great movie to discuss.
I thought Green Book is a great movie. What about Aquaman?
Even the, I mean, nobody likes Aquaman.
What do you mean, Aquaman? Yeah. It's perfect. I've often wondered when the creatures of the deep would finally rebel at all the garbage we're throwing on them and would throw it back up at us.
I already gave you three superhero movies right off the top. I can't throw a fourth one in.
And Aquaman was amazing.
It was. I'll take your word for it.
What about Vice? Did you see Vice?
I saw Vice.
I did see Vice.
That sounds interesting. Yeah. The cast looks awesome.
Adam McKay. It's the problem, Dave, is don't you think Vice is too much all over the map?
Yeah, well, it does really vilify Dick Cheney for basically everything that went wrong in this country.
I'm not sure
even he was capable of doing that much bad stuff.
But, you know, the ideal version of Vice is The Death of Stalin. That does a much sharper job of showing the hilarity and the outrageousness of people in power much more effectively than I think Vice.
Okay, I didn't realize Stalin ever ran this country, but okay, fine.
No, but as political metaphors, Dave.
I see.
Come on, run with me on this.
Okay.
Hey, play the number one sounder again.
You want the number one sounder again?
I want to be my walk-on music every time.
Number one.
Is in our hearts is Tom Tiny.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Tom.
Perfect. Thank you.
Let's move on to the Daily Dose of Kindness now. Lunchtime Angels, at it again locally. Cairo 7's Shelby Miller takes this story. It's about a law firm in Olympia that decided to start the new year with charity.
There you go. Covering the cost of school lunches for families struggling to get by.
It's not just a question of, you know, paying off this balance. It could be a major life decision for them of, do they pay the overdue payment to the school or do they pay for basic family needs?
A few weeks back, attorneys at Connolly Tackin and Meserve in Olympia heard a district hired a collections agency to handle soaring lunch debts.
And that just seemed so problematic. It seemed like so clearly the wrong way to approach it. And we just wanted to find a way to give back to the community that was tangible.
They decided to give back to the communities that built them. They paid off school lunch debts at their own schools, McLean and LP Brown Elementary Schools in Olympia, and they footed the bill for all of the Rainier School District.
This is just, such a great opportunity to try to make life better for some of the kids who are, you know, walking the same halls that I was walking when I was that age.
It really means a lot to have it be able to give back to the community I grew up in, the community that my kids attend.
Parents say the good news is spreading fast.
I thought that was great. We're a small community, and I love that, you know, the community gets together and, an alumni from the community was able to do that.
In all, it cost the firm about $2,000. They say the joy it's brought is priceless.
Those students might not ever, you know, remember that, you know, one day when they were in second grade, some law firm donated money. But we know that we made a difference. We know that we helped those families out during this holiday season. And that's what was really important to us.
And if this has piqued your interest, it's really easy, as we found out, to find out school lunch debts in your district. You just call them up. They'll tell you the total. We've seen many examples locally of GoFundMe campaigns or just somebody with some extra cash, maybe their tax return, and they go and pay off lunch debts at their school.
Nice thing to do. Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from that Olympic-sized swimming pool of sports, 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. When is the day going to come when the Seahawks of today are as feared as the Oakland Raiders of yesteryear?
Well, do you think the Seahawks were in 2013? They were as feared as the previous Mad Men of Oakland?
I don't know. What were they?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that was a swashbuckling defense.
Yeah.
Team that four straight years in which they allowed the fewest points. We'll see if they get back to that.
Yeah.
We'll see. They're not quite there yet, but 10 wins. They're going down to Dallas. I'm seriously hoping that they are able to register a victory, because I always love watching the Cowboys fans get humbled.
The injury report looks really good for
yes,
a change.
Yes, it does. Extremely optimistic. The two question marks, Trey Madden, their fullback, is doubtful because of a hamstring injury. And then J.R. Sweezy is questionable with a foot injury. He left. He suffered that injury 2 weeks ago. But the expectation is he's going to get out there and try and play on it. So I bet that we see him. I'm not sure if he'll finish the game, but I would expect that we see him at some point.
Okay, now, the Dallas Cowboys were considered America's. Are they still considered America's team?
Nobody ever considered them America's team. They called themselves America's team. And I would say that that's a certain amount of hubris, right? Like, who gets out there? We're America's team. No, you're not.
But
no,
I mean, it implies that there's a fan base that goes well beyond. Like, Hannah Scott, she comes in dressed as all week she's been dressed as some player from the Cowboys.
I would say this. Hannah's loyalty is admirable, because she is not a fair weather Cowboy fan. I generally think that most Cowboy fans who are not located in the state of Texas tend to also root for the Yankees, potentially Notre Dame, certainly the Lakers. They tend to be front runners, bandwagoners. And Chris Sullivan is not one of those bandwagoner when it comes to the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. But there are that's
I've got familiar ties to that.
There's a loyalty. The Cowboys are a team that has tended to attract some front runners who they're really out in front of the parade when it's going well, and when it's not going so well, you don't hear as much from them. They focus their loyalties on the Lake Show.
So what's your, in terms of feared players on the Cowboys, it all seems to be Zeke Elliott.
Zeke Elliott is the best running back in the league. He led the league in rushing. He also leads them in receiving. He is the most difficult player to match up with on that team. He's a great, great football player.
And so compared to like Marshawn Lynch.
Importance of, he's as important to the Cowboys as Marshawn Lynch was to the Seahawks when they won the Super Bowl. Yeah, that's a very good comparison.
Now, in terms of our running backs, they're all online now. Rashad Penny is back.
Penny is back. Chris Carson had a 1,000-yard rushing season.
Right.
That's the thing. Chris Carson's this season has been every bit as explosive as Ezekiel Elliott.
Is this due to the change? Didn't they change defensive coordinators at the Seahawks?
Yes, they did.
Okay. That's amazing. I even know that. But I mean,
it's good.
Is that the reason that suddenly everybody's talking about this awesome running game the Seahawks have?
No, it would be the new offensive coordinator.
Oh, the offense.
Because he's in charge of calling all the running plays. And they've got a new offensive line coach, Mike Solari.
See, I didn't know what I thought I knew.
No, you did. But anyway, you were right about the defensive coordinator change.
Yeah.
That was really good.
That was by accident, though.
Yeah, well, no.
It was the offensive coordinator I meant.
Well, but they were both there. You just got stumbled over nomenclature.
What I'm saying is, how many coordinators do you need? Isn't it the coach's job to call all that stuff? So he changes a coordinator of whether it's offense or defense, and then suddenly that part of the team plays differently?
Think of the head coach as more of the supervisor or the foreman in the construction job.
Yeah.
And the offensive coordinator is the guy that's in charge of the actual offensive schematics and game plan.
I see.
The coach isn't deciding which nut goes where and where to use the bolts. That's the offensive coordinator's job, in line with some of his staff, which includes the offensive line coach.
Right.
This year, you've got the same supervisor. He wants the same goal. He's outlining the same thing, but he got some different guys to work on the construction part of it. And it's been much better, because for the past 2 years, they've wanted to have the exact kind of rushing game that they now do have. And for the past 2 years, they were utterly incapable of summoning that up.
Right.
So I think that you're exactly right, Dave, that it is the offensive coordinator that's had a huge part in getting this run game back to where the Seahawks wanted.
So they finally hired a plumber who knew how to sweat a solder joint.
Yeah, maybe. That sounds good. Sounds about right.
Whatever. So who's going to win? What's your prediction? What's the score going to be? I'm writing it down. Here we go.
Seattle Seahawks 24, Cowboys 20.
Dave, and tell Danny what your score was that you came up, your prediction.
It was 29 to 28.2 because I took the – well, I haven't got time to go through – read my email. But I took the game since the Green Bay game when they got on their stride, and I added up the scores for each side of the team. I only used the ones where it was a one-score game because this is going to be a close game. And then I divided it by the games that qualify, which was five. And then I added 3 points for the home field advantage, and I got 28.8. Anyway, it's a 0.2. It's a tenth of a safety difference.
Now, Dave, no team in the history of football has ever scored 28.2 points.
I know.
It has never, ever happened.
Statistical thing.
On the flip side, I would tell you this, that Pete Carroll has an uncanny ability each year to play a game that is decided by a score that has never before been seen in the history of NFL football.
See?
So I'm not going to go out and say it's impossible because we've seen it. But
I think a good offensive coordinator could score 0.2 points.
That sounds like an unlikely final tally.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.